You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
Thank you for staying with us and joining us for this conversation where we're really asking, does biodiversity matter? And this is a session where we're going to have an exchange between young people and policymakers, and we're going to explore this issue in more detail. And just a couple of minor housekeeping points. I'm going to invite you, if you haven't already done it, to put your mobile phones on silent so we don't get disturbed. Secondly, just to let you know, this event is being live streamed over the Debating Europe platform. So there will be an exterior audience as well as an interior audience. And just to let you know that the Debating Europe platform has now got a community of a million citizens engaged in conversation about different aspects of European policies. They've got more than 200,000 Facebook and Twitter followers from across Europe, and more than 45,000 questions submitted by those citizens have been put in front of policymakers. So there is a big community out there with an interest in what we're doing. And after this session is over, the conversation will continue online on the Debating Europe website. So I encourage you to go there afterwards and to join that conversation. There is translation available in and out of French and German. All of the speeches will be in English, and we expect to engage with you in English. Can I just see, is there anyone who is expecting or needs French and German translation? Because if not, we can allow our hard-working translators to go home. There's nobody who needs French or German. Excellent. Well, translators, thank you very much for being willing to stay. And I know you had time limits on your activities today, but I think we're comfortable in English. Thank you very much. Excellent. Okay. So let me introduce to you who we have on the panel. My name is Tamsin Rose, and I'm a non-resident fellow for the Friends of Europe, which is helping to co-organise this panel. And I have with me, and I will start from my left-hand side, we have Benedikt Jávor, from member of the European Parliament from Hungary. He is also a professor of environmental law with a lot of experience in campaigning, and most particularly, he is a member of 40 Under 40, the European Young Leader of the Friends of Europe and Europa Nova Network. Sitting next to me, we have Hans Brunings, the Executive Director at the European Environment Agency. Sitting to my right, we have Leanne Tough, who's a member of the Phoenix Group of the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds from the UK. We have Maddie Bartlett, who is from Bristol, which I'm sure you've had a chance to visit the stands of Bristol outside. It's the Green City 2015. She's the founding chair of the Bristol Nature Network. And finally, on the end, we have Christian Schwarzer, who's a member of the steering committee of the Global Youth Biodiversity Network and a youth ambassador for the UN Decade for Biodiversity, which we're sort of in the middle of at the moment, that decade. So this is our panel. And the way that we're going to work is that each panelist has been given 5 minutes to make an introductory statement. Why does biodiversity matter? And to keep everyone on track, we have a five-minute hourglass, and then after that, we're going to open it up to conversation and debate with you. And I should let you know that in advance, I've received some questions already via the Debating Europe website, so I may add that into the conversation. But we also will want to hear from you why biodiversity matters. So let me start with Hans, as someone with overall responsibility at European level for measuring, monitoring, and assessing this stuff.
All right.
Why does it matter?
Well, thanks for inviting me to this event. And I would say the question that is raised in 2015 should be redundant. Why does biodiversity matter? If we don't understand why biodiversity matters today, we're in pretty bad shape. So I would like to say that, first of all, and obviously, biodiversity is the basis of our food system. Yeah, that seems to be pretty important if we want to stay alive. Secondly, it's the basis for abiotic resources. Imagine that we would not have the resources from the sort of nature base that we have. It would be impossible to build a society. Increasingly, we also understand the term ecosystem services, as you all know, and it has been quite central in the debate here. It's clean water, clean air, all of those things. And in addition to that, we have been understanding much better what biodiversity brings in terms of health, both physical health to human beings, but also increasingly mental health. People who live close to or are connected to biodiversity in its broad sense, they tend to be mentally more healthy. And that, as we all know, at the beginning of the 21st century is increasingly a worry, especially in highly advanced societies. Now, besides all those services, I obviously am aware that there is the whole debate about the intrinsic value about biodiversity. So that is also a clear thinking. Now, when we think of biodiversity on a planet where we are adding 2 to 3 billion people in the next decades, and we will rely on those ecosystem services and on all the good things that come from nature and the food system that we will require, it's clear that we have some serious challenges. Because in the agency, we have brought together in a recent study that we are supporting the European institutions with on nature and habitats, how we are doing with these resources. And first, a little bit of the positive news. We see some improvements at the level of species and habitats where policies are particularly well implemented and where they are really focused. That's where we see improvements at the local and regional level primarily. And we see that the Natura 2000 network, for example, plays a pretty strong role in those precise approaches. But if we look at the more negative trends, we can look at status, evolution, and responses. The status is that only 16% of the habitats and only 23% of the species are actually in favorable condition. That's less than one-fourth and one-fifth. In unfavorable condition, we have almost 80% of the habitats and 60% of the species. So we cannot pop a bottle of champagne over those results. This is not good. When we look at the evolution, we also see that 30% of the habitats have further deteriorated in the last decade. Also, this is not a positive trend. And what is the response that we see today besides implementing policies and following up on that? I would say there are two critical new responses. One is the response of valuation. We need to value ecosystems in a more explicit way so that when we make choices about economics or about where we should invest, we at least have a measurement that we can use to weigh off things or to discuss trade-offs in a more rational way. And in the agency, we are working on several projects that look at valuation of ecosystem services and biodiversity. The second approach, which I think was quite central in this Green Week, was what we now call working with nature to create solutions for society, nature-based solutions. And here I think the message should be very clear. Those who will expect strong solutions based on weak nature, they are going to be in for a tough ride, because it's quite obvious that you cannot have strong nature-based solutions if you don't have strong nature. So working with our natural capital, preserving it, strengthening it, protecting it, and using it in sustainable ways will be absolutely crucial. I would say that the third important message from our recent report is that if we want to actually do this, we will need to tackle biodiversity as it is linked to crucial systems in society. We need to reflect on the link between biodiversity and the food and agricultural system, which puts huge pressures on biodiversity. We also need to reflect on the role of urban design and spatial planning when it comes to pressures on biodiversity. And as we all know, those are quite contentious issues where people have rather different positions based on their interests. So this is actually a highly political debate. But finally, to stay within my time, or more or less within my time, when we think of the future, and that was also one of the questions, could you look forward? I think it is quite clear that we have to move away from this discourse of the future generations. The urgency is too high. You know, it's your generation. It's this generation. Yeah? Because the discourse of future generations suggests that we still have a couple of generations to take care of things. We don't. We don't. Most of you will be alive in 2070 and 2080. We need to turn it around now. It's this generation with the choices that we make today on our food system, on our energy system, on how we design our cities, on how we design mobility that will determine the future of natural capital and also the future of climate change and all of those things. So while it's nice to speak about, you know, your children and grandchildren, because that's what we then usually say in policy or in political terms, it's now that it needs to happen. So it's your generation, it's our future, and if we don't work with nature and preserve what we have and strengthen what we have, I think we will be in for a very dire ride. So that would be my short introduction.
Well, thank you. You've certainly made it very clear that the time is now for real decision-making, and the decisions need to not be small. These are very big issues you talked about, urban planning, the food and agriculture system. We need systematic strategic thinking, which brings me now to our colleague in the European Parliament. Why does biodiversity matter, and is the Parliament ready to make these kinds of decisions now and not in two elections' time?
Thank you, and thank you for the invitation to this interesting debate. As you mentioned, I was member of this 40 under 40 network, which is a very important network. Unfortunately, those times are over, as I'm not under 40 anymore. In my 5 minutes time slot, I would like just to raise some points. Most of you might be familiar with the ecological footprint conception. Ecological footprint calculations show us that right now humanity is 1.5 Earth, 50% more than basically we could. And the models suggest that if we go on the way, on the track we are right now on, by 2050, humanity will use 4 planets. The question is if it's possible or not. I think that the answer is clearly not. There is no any possibility to use 4 planets. So this will be changed in a way or another. The real question is not if we decrease our pressure on nature, on ecosystems. The only question is how it happens. It happens through catastrophic natural events, different problems in society in an uncontrolled way, through conflicts and disasters, or it happens through well-controlled, or more or less well-controlled and regulated way, with ambitious regulation, ambitious political decisions, and ambitious change of our lifestyles. So the question is if decision-making in the European institutions, and not only the Parliament, as decision-making in the European institutions, the Parliament is just one part and perhaps not the strongest part of decision-making. But the question is if we are able and we are committed to make the right decisions to make this change controlled and regulated or not. Just to mention 3 important areas where decisions should be made. And to start the good news, let's start with climate change. European Union and the European Council last October accepted a Council conclusion on renewables, energy efficiency, and CO2 emission reduction targets. And the EU is seeming to be a forerunner of climate change efforts globally. On resource use, which was mentioned by Hans, a circular economy package was introduced to the European Parliament, and it is to turn our economy from a linear system into a circular system, and resources are not mined in, from one point, and by the end of the day, all the resources are turned into waste, but to create a circular economy, which I think it's a revolution how we think about economy and society. And on biodiversity, we have the Birds and Habitat Directive, Natura 2000 Network, Nature Directives, which proved to be quite effective. As Hans mentioned, there are some developments in European ecosystems. And here comes the bad news. All those efforts we have in these three areas are enough to make a controlled and regulated change globally. And unfortunately, I have to say that it's far from being enough. On climate issues, all the efforts and commitments which are made by the member states and some other countries all over the world are not on the track to keep climate change within the limits of the 2-degree track. Basically, we are on a 4-degree track at least. So climate change, if we cannot change deeply our commitments and policies, is far beyond the limits of sustainability. On circular economy, we have this proposal from the previous commission. Where we are now, the proposal is withdrawn by the Commission right now, and we have a very heavy fight with the Commission to come back as soon as possible with a stronger proposal. And on biodiversity, the Birds and Habitat Directive might be quite effective. We have some problems with implementation, but the reaction of the Commission is not to strengthen implementation, but a revision of the Birds and Habitat Directive, which might come next year. And this clearly a huge threat to those directives, and this change might undermine all those efforts. So just to conclude, the question for me is if we are able to control the changes which will happen for sure globally, this will be a regulated change or some catastrophic Hollywood movie. And if our decisions are the right decisions to be on the right track, we are not on the right track, I'm sure. So what we need are stronger commitments in each of the mentioned policy areas. The Parliament is doing its best, and its best is still not enough, but it's still stronger than let's say, the Commission or the Council. The Parliament is doing its best to be on the right track, but we need support from the society, because Commission and Member States government will keep their eyes on citizens, on voters, and they will change their approach and policies only if they feel that the society needs that.
Excellent, thank you. So the challenge there is the change is coming. Are we going to be able to manage it, or is it going to be catastrophically and inflicted on us? It's a big challenge ahead. So let me now turn to Leanne from the Royal Society of Protection of Birds. Obviously, if you're out bird watching and you're engaged in that, you are seeing the changes happening. You're experiencing biodiversity. And you've just heard that the you're likely to be alive still in 2050 and 2070. I very much hope so. So you're going to be seeing what's coming. What's the viewpoint of your community?
Hello, I'm Leanne Tuff, and I'm from the RSPB. I'm a 17-year-old bird watcher and general nature lover, and it's great to see so many young faces out this out today. So I'm part of the Phoenix Forum, which is the teenage membership of the RSPB, and through that I'm one of 10 who represent the about 45,000 Phoenix members, which is a great driving force. And we do this through meetings across the country and at Bird Fair as well, which is something that happens in the UK. It's a big international event. Everybody here, I'm sure, has got a massive passion for nature, and I know there's lots of teenagers out there who have it. Maybe they don't admit it. But it's great to see that there's people here who have that same opinion. So I just want to say that Rutland Water, which is where Bird Fair is held, is such an important place, not only for the fact that it was made for the nature directives, it was made to mitigate the impacts of low reservoir levels on when there's a high demand for water, because it's a functioning reservoir. And it's the biodiversity there is massive. You can see bitterns, ospreys, all sorts. It was the in 2001, it had the first osprey to fledge in over 150 years. And so the main message that we want to get across, definitely the RSPB and many people here, is that these directives, when they're implemented properly, they seriously do work. And they've provided, one of the best nature reserves in the UK, and they're good for business by providing water to tens of thousands of homes in the Midlands. And that's one of the main reasons why we've come from the UK today, is to bring that across. And definitely biodiversity, we all know it's good for your health. They say that it could save so much money for our National Health Service if people took time to go out into nature more often. And I think that's a very crucial point, that we need to protect these areas for the future generations, because, yes, we will be alive for a lot longer, hopefully. yes, so that's the main point today.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And I mean, you've made the important point about the link between access to nature and physical and mental health, as did Hans and Benedict. If one in four Europeans at some point in their life is expected to experience a mental health problem, that's a significant proportion of the population that could benefit from access to green spaces. And we also know that the evidence is building that exercise and getting out into nature is as effective for basic depression than antidepressants. So when you said that there's a huge potential to save money for the health system, there's a huge potential for people to feel better if they get access to the green spaces that could be put in place through these kinds of directives. So thank you for raising that. Okay, now we're going to move over to Maddie Bartlett, who's from Bristol and the Green Capital 2015. She was one of the founding chairs of the Bristol Nature Network. Tell us more about your network's view about the value and importance of biodiversity.
Okay, I think in the UK, in the last 50 years, 60% of our wildlife has declined. 97% of our wildflower meadows have disappeared in the last 50 years, and I'm sure it's a similar outlook across Europe as well. And I think that says why biodiversity is important. We're losing it, and I think that we're also losing our connection with biodiversity. I think a lot of the time people seem to have this idea where they say that you kind of think of nature on one hand and people on the other hand, but we forget that actually we are part of nature. We're part of that big connection. So I think really the question that I want to ask is, how can we support biodiversity? Because that's what we offer with the Bristol Nature Network. So we help young people develop skills to help them in their careers. So things like wildlife identification, biological recording, things like that to set them up in the environmental sector. And we also support them to communicate with like-minded people and with other environmental organisations. And I think that communication is really the key thing. So being able to talk to other people and share your ideas. So the Bristol Nature Network actually took off really quickly. We set up 14 months ago. Our first meeting, we had over 100 people turn up. And 14 months later, we've got over 600 members. And I think the reason that took off so quickly was because we offered the opportunities to to connect people on a scale that they hadn't been able to before. I've seen this work on a city level as well. So, as Tamsin said, Bristol's the green capital of Europe for 2015. And again, I think the thing that's been so successful about that is that it's offered opportunities for organisations to connect with one another, which has meant that instead of having kind of individual projects going on, they've been able to come together and have a much bigger impact. One of my other roles is that I'm on the committee for a new report that we're pulling together called the Vision for Nature Report, which I'm working on with a group called A Focus on Nature, which is kind of like the Bristol Nature Network, but on a national scale. And the report's hoping to outline what young people want the natural world to look like in 2050 and how we might achieve that. And something that's really stuck out for me in gathering the information in that report is that young people are actually, well, I don't know about you, but in my own experience as well, I've been made to feel embarrassed about having an interest in nature, or made to feel unpopular. And I think that if we can open up communication around nature and make it something that everybody gets, and incorporate it into everyday life and start to redefine it as something that's accessible to everybody rather than to just a few people, then nature will be an interest that takes centre stage culturally in the same way that music does or art does. I think that the main thing that we should be looking for from governments is that they start looking in the long term. And I think the best way to do that is to invest in young people. So by supporting opportunities for young people and organisations to communicate with one another and to be able to talk about their interest in nature openly and not feel embarrassed about it. And therefore helping to bring nature into the mainstream. I think that's really important. I think only when we begin to encourage that change in behaviour and start talking about it openly will we begin to see a progress in the protection of the natural world. I think if the majority of people are interested in something, then the powers that be have to take notice as well. I think communication is the key. Excellent. I think we've run out of time.
Thank you. So, I mean, both of you have shared your experiences of working with groups of young people in your area. Obviously, you work at a national level, you're working in Bristol, but this isn't just an issue for Europe, is it, biodiversity? Christian, you work on UN and at global level.
So exactly.
I'm sure you have an additional viewpoint you can share with us why biodiversity matters so much and why it has resonance for global youth.
Well, it is really something that we can only tackle when we think on a multidimensional scale. We have to act on the local, on the regional, on the national, on the European, and also on the global level, because biodiversity loss doesn't stop at national borders. It's something that you cannot fix in just one country. You have to fight it everywhere. And let me just start with the question you gave us. Why does biodiversity matter? Hans described this very well. Biodiversity is the basis of everything. It's the basis of our economy. It's the basis of life. It's the basis of all our resources, of all the things that we're doing here, and it is the basis for the generations of the future. And Hans said this, and I just want to follow up on this. It's not about we are not the young people are not the leaders of tomorrow. We must be the leaders of today, because the changes are so rapid and the need for action is so urgent that we have to start doing this now. And just a few days back, I've been at a baby shower of one of my friends, and it's really weird for me because I'm now in my late 20s and my friends are starting to get babies. It feels really weird. And one of these things at the baby shower was that the mother was asking us to draw some paintings that we could give to the yet unborn baby with our wishes for the future. And I was thinking, what am I going to wish this baby that will live far beyond the year 2100, I think? And Well, I was drawing a very crappy painting. It's definitely not my talent. And I was drawing a forest with a river. It was looking quite ridiculous, but this is actually what I wish for this baby, that she can live in a world in the year 2100 with all the natural diversity that I could experience. The natural diversity that made me become an environmentalist, that made me become so fascinated with all these things that I dedicated most of my life towards working for this. Why are we doing this? Because over half of the world's population is under 30. Over half of the world's population. And all of us in the next couple of decades will be most negatively affected by the loss of biodiversity. And as Hans pointed out, we cannot just point the finger into the future. We need to act now. We need to engage young people. We need to make young people part of the solution. And young people want this. We want to take responsibility. And I think when we look at young people and what they do for biodiversity, we see a very contrasting picture. Because on the one hand, a lot of studies are showing us that the awareness and especially the understanding for the value of biodiversity is shockingly low among young people. Like, there is a study that was published in the UK that was proving that young people know more Pokemon than they know natural species, or that young people were not able to distinguish a bee from a wasp. This is really shocking. This is something we have to do. But on the other hand, I don't like media to paint this picture of my generation that we're all apathetic, that we're just hanging in front of our smartphones, in front of TV screens, and that we're not going out anymore. Of course we all have smartphones. Smartphones are great. Smartphones are helping us, and they can be a great tool to reconnect with nature. But we also have thousands of young people all over the world that are taking real action for biodiversity conservation in all aspects of life. I have friends that are fighting against deforestation in Indonesia, people that are volunteering for national parks in Canada. I have friends that are cleaning up rivers in Africa. There is a huge variety of things that young people can do. And this is what I've been working on in the last 5 years. The thing is, what shocks me the most is that I didn't meet Maddie and Leanne before. I mean, you guys are doing awesome things. Why didn't we have this meeting like 2 years before and talked about what you do in Bristol, what you do with the RSPB? And this is exactly what I'm trying to change. So together with a couple of friends, we create the Global Youth Biodiversity Network, which is an initiative entirely run by young people. We met at a UN summit in Nagoya in 2010, and we just realized we're basically all doing the same things around the world. But there is no common platform that allows us to work together, to exchange ideas, to inspire each other. So we created this network, and since then we have grown to 342,000 members from 87 countries. We also have 20 European countries represented. So there is a massive demand for young people to get active, to have a platform where they can connect with. And what we're trying to do is to raise the awareness, to raise the understanding for young people of biodiversity. We try to build capacity for young people so that they cannot get active on biodiversity. We're trying to empower them. We try to show them opportunities on how they can create change and how they can help to stop the loss of biodiversity. And we're coordinating youth participation in the CBD, which is the international negotiating framework where politicians come together to set the global framework for action on biodiversity. And we want young people to have a voice in these negotiations. But I see my 5 minutes are over. I still have so many things that I could say. But just to summarize it, if we want to tackle the biodiversity crisis, if we want biodiversity not to be lost in a couple of decades, young people need to become part of the solution, and we need to engage them all. We need to engage them on all levels. And what I'm really missing is we need a European youth movement for biodiversity. There are so many great things happening, but we need to bring these people together. And that's what I would like to discuss further with you. Thank you so much for giving me a few extra minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Christian, and for your passion and commitment. And for really highlighting the fact that there are young people all around the world committing their time and their energy to practical, concrete actions on biodiversity. It's worth recognising it's not just about laws and implementing directives. Okay, so at this point, I'd like to open up to the floor, and I see already three hands raised. Because it's going to be web streamed, what we need you to do is stand up when you ask your question. But I have to provide apologies in advance. One of our panelists, Benedict Strictly, has to leave in a few minutes. So if a question comes forward and he can answer, we'll give him the time immediately. Yes, let's take the first question over here. Stand up, please.
I don't have a question, it's particularly for him. So someone else who...
Hi there, I'm Paul from the Netherlands. Before I ask my question, I would like to applaud this podium, which are like gender balanced and youth, and well, not youth balanced. Very good, very well done. Every panel should be like this. My question is as follows. First question, then a small explanation. The question is, how can we interest youth more in biodiversity? Me, as my experience, as I'm a volunteer for World Wildlife Fund for Nature, I do a lot of youth activities. I'm also a teacher. And from my experience is that it's becoming, as Christian says, very difficult nowadays to involve youth in biodiversity.
Okay.
Finally, before that adds to the question, should we, like for example in the case of where there's a factory polluting in, let's say, a developing country, should we, instead of trying to help those people which are suffering from the pollution, remove the pollution source, so look better at the sources? So should we, this is more a debate question maybe, should we instead, for example, focus on all the perverse things that move youth away from investing their time and their interest in biodiversity? Should we, for example, limit the amount of commercials relating to whatever things companies throw at them?
Okay. So, I know you've only got a few minutes. Do you want to take that?
Yeah, just very shortly, how to make youth interested in biodiversity. I believe that youth is interested in biodiversity. The problem, I believe, it's much more like not if they are interested, but if they believe that they can do anything to protect biodiversity. For 15 years I was teaching at university, and we made some surveys with my students how the people see the opportunities for public action to participate in decision making. And the sad result was that the younger the people were who we asked, the more disillusioned they were. The youngest generation, or the youngest deciles of the society, was the most disillusioned, and they believed the most in the fact that they are not able to make a change in society. It doesn't work to participate in decision making, including participating in elections, direct democracy to participate in this decision making at the local level. So the obstacle and the goal, I think, it's not only to make youth interested, being interested in biodiversity, because also this study showed that the young generation knows much more about environmental problems than their parents do. They know almost everything, or the most important thing, on the situation globally, but they don't believe that they are taken into consideration, they can make a change. And I think that this is at the point where we have to attack and to mobilize young generation, that you can do things. And all the initiatives we heard here in the panel, I think it's very important to prove the young generation that it's upon you. It's upon you to make the difference. It's upon you to change things, to change decision-making, to put the pressure on decision-makers. And you can do it on the local level, in your small village, and you can do it globally on the UN level, or you can go to Paris at the end of this year to participate at the COP21 on climate change and express your views on that.
Excellent, thank you. And we very much appreciate your participation.
Very sorry for leaving. Unfortunately, it's something I cannot change.
Excellent. And we'll perhaps take in another couple of questions so that the panel can respond to them all. So, yes, there's a hand up here, and we'll come back to this gentleman. So, if you stand up, this lady here, give her the microphone, please. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Marta Messa from Slow Food. I actually wanted to mention that there is also Slow Food Youth Network. It's a worldwide network of young people like you who are very much committed to a sustainable food system, to protecting biodiversity through food production, because food and agriculture are one of the major factors in the loss or in the protection of biodiversity. So we're working for the protection and promotion of food biodiversity. And we're actually organizing a meeting from the 3rd to the 6th of October in Milan in the context of Expo called We Feed the Planet, asking the question, who decides on the future of food, and asking that question to the young generation, saying, we are the ones who are going to feed the planet, let's discuss it. Now, the question to the panel is, are you already collaborating with young farmers, young producers, young artisans, and if not, then it'd be great to get in touch and exchange contacts. Thank you.
Lovely. Excellent. Thank you. And we have a question over here. And while the microphone is moving, I should just let you know that Benedict's intervention was highly relevant, because one of the questions that we received in advance on the Debating Europe website essentially said, Rick Hopman said, there are plenty of possibilities for individuals to help protect biodiversity. They're easy to implement and you can see the impact of your effort. I'm sure our panellists would agree with that. But the problem is that many people do not know about the options, and I would appreciate if the EU would make the effort to educate people on how they could help biodiversity. So, okay.
My name is Sven Arts. I'm a former member of Youth Environment Europe. I'm also an artist, and I'm currently the one of the environmental judges of the Brussels Capital Region. And actually, I can answer Christian's question on why haven't you met 2 years before, and why is there no more already a worldwide network for youth? Because actually I was somebody like you. I was just born in 1970. Actually there is a European network of environmental organizations which is called Youth Environment Europe. Now probably the reason why, I don't know if you are a member of Youth Environment Europe, of the umbrella organization, the two ladies there, are you? Are there any people here from Veldbeelgerna or Deutsche Jugendbundstudie or something? No. That is exactly the difficulty, the issue. The whole movement of youth environmental movement started in 1945, just after the Second World War. And then our world readers, was actually the first time that they came together to organize the World War. And that they realized that actually we didn't know anything about the environment. And that's why they set up the UNESCO, who then further...
Do you have a question for our panel?
No, if you are going to do it like that. If there is anybody who wants to know more about the history of youth environmental organizations and how to restore that, please come to me after the session then, okay?
Okay, great, thank you. So now I'm going to invite our panel members to respond to the messages that we heard. How do we get young people interested? How do we link the efforts in slow food and food production, artisans and farmers, with some of the actions that you're taking? Particularly, I'd like to hear from Maddie, because I know you're doing work in an urban environment. That's a bit of a gap, the urban-rural integration that needs to happen. So who would like to respond?
I'm happy to. Yeah. Is this working? Like you say, I work with a lot of youth that live in an urban environment. We do still try and do bits with, for example, there's a gleaning network in the UK that goes and collects unused fruit and vegetables from farms and brings it into the city and makes it usable. So we put those opportunities out to our members and try and get volunteers for them to go out and help with that. And I think the thing is with the network is that we try and give as many opportunities as we can and try and pull in not just urban organisations, but organisations that work in other cities and outside as well. I think when I want to answer the question about how do we get young people interested in nature as well, because I think that's a question I keep asking as well, and that I wanted to ask today myself. I think it's really hard to know, because I think that's a problem that a lot of people have. We take our members to the pub quite a lot, which helps. So that's, yeah, all of our events end in the pub, but then you've got the gap of anyone that's underage. So it's very difficult to know how to actually engage people and how to actually make it interesting. But I think if you can link it to things like art and music and things that young people are generally interested in, and like that is kind of culturally interested in, then you can start interacting with other groups that wouldn't necessarily just go for the nature. So again, we do things like pub quizzes and stuff like that, and we're holding an exhibition later in the year for wildlife photographers and artists. And so I think it's working at it from different angles to try and get different groups of people interested in it.
Excellent. Did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I can do.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, as I said earlier, the RSPB, we have our Phoenix, and we've also got the Wildlife Explorers, which is little kids as well. And that is a fantastic way of connecting people with nature. And I know the Wildlife Trust in the UK do a similar thing. And that brings people together, because you can be quite isolated. I don't know if you've experienced that in appreciating nature. It's something that teenagers don't openly express. And I met a fantastic sculptor last year who said we should make One Direction go bird watching. And I think that, yeah, something like that would really work. But I think it comes down to education. I think I'd love to see the, I don't know about other countries, but the UK government doesn't really look at educating teenagers in issues of biodiversity and in nature. And I'd love to see that be a big thing in the agenda, because as it's now coming to such a crucial point, I think it's time now that we should be putting back into schools about nature, even if it's just, you know, digging a garden or digging a pond or something. That's enough to encapsulate some people. Mm.
So, Hans, just picking up on what's just been said, Benedict, before he left, he talked about the fact that he's been surveying the university students, and he's found that the sort of the youngest of all of the cohort that he interviewed actually knew more about the environmental problems than their parents. Perhaps less, I mean, Christian, you mentioned that they may have less actual knowledge about different species, but they get the big picture about the problems, but they feel the most disempowered, the furthest away from decision-making, and the least able to effect a change with all of these problems. So from your point of view, how do we get young people to feel empowered and build up an interest on biodiversity?
Okay, well, let me start with the educational system, because I, until 2 years ago, I was actually a university professor on this type of stuff, so working on a day-to-day basis with young people. And I would say the educational system is not very good when it comes to issues of biodiversity. I mean, it's probably better when it comes to pollution and pressures and to climate change nowadays, although I have to say that the elementary school system that my kids have been going through and are going through is much better, is doing a much better job than most universities at this moment, where it's still highly siloed and not very much connected. So I think one challenge in the educational system is not only focus on problems and pollution and understanding that, but on what are the positive solutions, how can you connect to this future-oriented dimension of biodiversity. The second thing I would say is that most young people in Europe grow up in an urban context. I mean, that's what it is, right? So when you think of giving them, I think, first of all, an environmental experience, an ecological experience. We find it very normal in most European countries that you take the kids on an annual trip to, I don't know, Paris, London, Berlin, Amsterdam, wherever you go. But we would find it very strange to take them on a week-long trip in nature. Yeah? And probably they would experience things in a very different way, which they have never experienced before. And I have great admiration for people who know 100 bird species. I personally don't. I wouldn't recognize 20 of them, I guess. But I don't. That might be one of the issues. I don't think we should represent nature to young people as something like you need to know 50 species and you need to be able to determine plants. Again, I think it's very important and I have admiration for people who do, but the sort of experience level in nature, I think, is very important. And, you know, I'm now living and working in the city of Copenhagen. I can tell you that the quality of the water there is so good in the summer that the public pools in Copenhagen is the harbor. And it's full of young people who are in touch somehow with blue in the city. Yeah, why can't we think of an urban jungle where kids can experience all the fun stuff or young people that they want to do in a sort of urban, exciting environment that brings nature into the city? Why can't we indeed draw on young people's talents when it comes to art and photography and, I don't know, rapping and other stuff? I'm sorry that I'm getting too excited about nature here. That taps into their worldview and their life when it comes to this type of experiences. I think nature has to be part of a positive, deeper experience if we want to empower people and make them feel as if they are part of something. Because intellectually, you can try to bring the horse to the water, but it's much easier to do it when there is an experience there that has more to it than just intellectual knowledge, in my opinion. And we have not researched this at the agency. This is just me speaking in the panel from my own past experiences there. If you have had a deep ecological experience in your life, and I don't necessarily mean that in a religious or a transcendental thing, but where you have been in nature in a way in which you have never been before, and you feel connected to it, and you feel forces, and you're maybe scared a bit, I mean, it's really transformative, and it connects you to something that you cannot know if you have no experience with it. So I'll leave it at that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Christian, do you want to come in on this?
Yeah, there are a lot of things. It's hard to speak after Hans because he mentions all the important points already. Well, first of all, I can only repeat, everything starts with education. And I think it is a scandal that we have economics as a major subject in school, that we have mathematics, but at least for Germany, I can say, I hope other countries are more progressive, we don't have environmental education as a subject in schools. And I think we really need to make this a mandatory subject. A couple of years ago, we've been running a campaign at the UN level to convince governments to take a decision on this so that we can move forward with it. But no government was really excited about it. And I think this is a shame. Then I think to respond to the first question, how can we involve young people in biodiversity? I think we first have to help them to understand and to raise their awareness for the values of biodiversity. They need to understand why it is important, and we need to make it attractive. We need to give young people a creative space where they can work on biodiversity, that can work with elementary school education, where kids just go out and do something active in the nature. And in an older age, like people that graduated from high school, I think what really has helped me was meeting other people that are enthusiastic about biodiversity too. Like, until a couple of years ago, I was helping organizing European Youth Perspective conferences on a range of environmental issues. We did one on climate change, then our colleagues in the Netherlands did one on consumption, then there was another one on biodiversity. But the last one was 5 years ago. But conferences like this are incredible platforms to bring all this creative energy of young people together. These are really the nucleus of movements that we need. And the gentleman over there mentioned that we have all these structures in Europe already. But at the moment, the only youth environmental networks that I'm aware of are Youth and Environment Europe and Young Friends of the Earth Europe, but they don't
focus so much on biodiversity, but on other very important issues. And I think we need to do something that the organizations that are out there, that they give a greater attention to biodiversity issues. I think it's also about showing young people perspectives. Why can it be a good investment for you to focus on environmental issues? Of course, biodiversity is the basis for all our life. But what you, Maddie, are doing in Bristol, that you're connecting people to career opportunities, this is also another opportunity how you can raise people's awareness and show them like the amazing opportunities that are in the environmental sector. I think what we really need for young people in order to empower them is sort of a yes, we can for biodiversity campaign. We need to show people that whatever they do, that there are many ways for them to have a real impact on the ground with conservation activities. We need to show them how many youth and organizations, how many environmental organizations are out there, how they can get active there. And I think we need to also to create space within our education system for this. I studied in a bachelor's master system. There was hardly any time to do anything outside of the schedule if I would have aimed to finish my degree within the 6 semesters or the 4 semesters for a master's. I think everything is so streamlined now that people don't have time to just take a semester off and to work for an environmental organization, to volunteer in a nature park, and we need to put these spaces, we need to put them in. It has to get attractive to have some, how can I say, loopholes in your CV. It should not be considered as a loophole, it should be considered as an added benefit. And I think we need to open more opportunities for young people to participate in political processes, because there is the one dimension where young people can change something on the ground, but there is also the other dimension where people are getting increasingly apathetic when it comes to political decision-making, where they feel that they cannot change anything, and the European Union needs to do more to involve young people in biodiversity decision-making. Final point, just 1 second. There was the lady that talked about the Slowfoot Youth Network, and I'm really happy that they're one of the member organizations of the Global Youth Biodiversity Network. And yes, absolutely. What we do when we organize delegations to international UN conferences, we try to make it as diverse as possible in terms of gender, in terms of regional balance, and if we receive applications from young farmers, great, because we need this diversity, and we need to connect young farmers to people that work on the urban level, that work anywhere else. We need to create this movement.
Thank you for that, Christian. I'm going to come back to pick up on something that Hans mentioned. I'm aware that time is ticking away. We've got 10 minutes left in our panel. And Christian, you said we need space, not just green spaces, but space in terms of time and space in careers and opportunities to allow people to develop and express these ideas and go out and practice it. And this brings me to something that you said, Hans. You said it's about how we make different values. How we value nature, then how we evaluate that into our lives and our systems to help make better choices, whether they're policy choices, legislative choices, or career choices. Is there anything you want to add on to that?
Very briefly, because I want more questions probably to come, but we know from social science that people feel much more enriched, engaged, connected by experiences than by having things. So by doing things much more than by having things. And so I think if you want to connect to new values in society, and this is, you know, biodiversity and what it means is rather new, I think we should focus on those things that give people the qualities and the connections and the experiences that they want. So I would plead for, when it comes to nature, experientialism. That you need the connection, you need to understand, you need to feel. It has to be something thrilling, you know. You need to want to go there. Yeah.
Thrilling experience is needed in nature. That makes sense. More comments or questions in our last few minutes? Has anyone had a thrilling experience in nature? I'll come back to you if there's nobody. Yes. Please, that's it, stand up.
Wouldn't it be very interesting? I really want to stress, Ale, you are not many who are interested in environment and who are engaged in environment as being young youth or youth adults. But we have to be a little bit practical, and I want to follow up on what Christian was saying. You really have to be a little bit practical. I really think it would be a good idea if all of you, at the end of this session, you would send a tweet with hashtag EU Green Week and then something with youth, for example, so that you can all afterwards connect and keep building things up.
Okay, I did mention at the beginning of the session that this is being web streamed on the Debating Europe platform, and that after this session closes in a few minutes, there will be an online debate. So this conversation can keep going, and I hope very much that the connections that you've started to make here will continue online. But thank you for that. Yes, did you want to say something? Yes.
Does it work? Yeah. I want to come back on Christian Schwartz's point. He said it's a pity or disappointed that not many young people take half a year off to experience something. I did it myself. I went away for 2 years. But one part which is missing here is that parents don't motivate it because society doesn't, they accept it, but it doesn't fit in the perfect ideal society picture people have. Children have to go to school, get education, do their studies, get a job. That is how most people and most parents see it for their children. So should we not incorporate parents in this to teach children and motivate children to do it? Because at this moment we say children don't do it, but if no one inspires them to do it, they will never do it.
Yeah. Okay, good point. That yes, did you want to make a last comment before we'll come back, and then I'll invite all of the panelists to have just a final word because we've got 5 minutes left. Yes.
If that is true, that is really very worrisome, because we have been campaigning very actively on the link between formal education and non-formal education, and I hope that maybe some of the panelists can also comment on that. But I really hope that you see a little bit that you are too dispersed in so many different small organizations, and you have so many adult organizations who want your nice face as young people and as kids, so that they can pull even more resources, the scarce resources that actually should go to young people. They actually pull them in adult organizations, and they only want to interact with young kids. But from the moment that you are a teenager and you dare to talk back, then they don't want you anymore. You really have to come together in one big organization like Youth Environment Europe.
Thank you. You've made your point that you want us all in the one organization, Youth Environment Europe. Okay. Panelists, we've had a lively debate, lots of ideas, passion and interest from the audience, potential connections that people can see, but a strong plea for there to be better education about the value of green space. And I think it links back perhaps to some of the things you said about it needs to be green space and nature needs to be as culturally relevant as music and art and other things are to young people. So final words from all of the panelists. I'll start with Christian and we'll work our way back.
All right, yeah, I think this was very, very interesting, all the comments. Just to respond to the comment that you gave, I'm really jealous that you had the chance to take 2 years off. One of the greatest regrets in my life that I didn't do this. I think this is one of the best things that people can do, and I really hope that we will get to a society that values this, because these are the experiences that matters. These are the experiences that form responsible citizens, and that's what we need for Europe, that's what we need for biodiversity. I'm very happy that we have this event here, that we have a space in Green Week to discuss about youth issues and how we can get young people more engaged in biodiversity issues. But as we can see, 75 minutes are clearly not enough to get young people engaged. And I hope for the next time, maybe we can even organize a youth conference that is preceding the Green Week, and then young people can come here with their ideas and discuss with adults on an eye level and how we can integrate this. I think this would be a wish that I would like to express for the future. That would be my wish for the future.
Maddie.
I think thanks everybody for your questions, and I
completely agree with what everyone's been saying. But I think at the same time, we kind of talk about these one moments, these experiences that people have, and that comes up a lot in when I've been to other conferences and during this conference as well. For me, I never had a moment like that, and so I think that actually it was a kind of drip, drip, drip thing that happened and slowly went in. And I think that actually kind of hoping that everybody will have an experience that will get them into nature in some way is a bit of a big wish, which a lot of, you know, I think that we can try and make sure that that happens more often, and like you say, motivate parents to encourage children to go outdoors and to go out and travel the world and things like that. But at the same time, I think that like Christian said, if we can bring that into the curriculum and make that something that people learn every day going to school, so whether that's learning outside or the actual information that they're being taught is about nature in some way, and I think there's so many different ways of bringing nature in, so that it's almost a subliminal message, so people start caring about it in a way that that they don't necessarily at the moment, and that it doesn't necessarily need that big wow moment in their lives, but that it's just there already from day one. So.
Leanne, would you like to add anything?
I'll be quick because I can see time is flying. The whole thing about getting parents involved, well, it's, you know, it's a known fact now that our parents will say, I used to go out in the street and I used to play, and, you know, it just doesn't happen anymore. And I think things that, if parents, you can't change parents, like coming back to the education thing, there's also things like in the UK forest schools, just even if it's a day, getting children out just to have that experience or just to connect for that one moment, I don't think they'll ever lose that. And I think that's important.
Excellent, thank you. Hans.
Okay, I'm on the old side of the panel here. I didn't know there was an organization 40 under 40. I could be a member of 50 over 50. I don't know whether it exists. But anyway, I do think as a parent that we should get parents involved. Obviously, I am involved. No, in all seriousness, I think biodiversity and its protection is absolutely necessary. It's fundamental. We will not build a strong future society without strong nature. That's clear. Secondly, there is urgency there, because it is degrading. It's degrading globally, it's degrading at the European level, so we need to do something about it. Thirdly, it's good because it's about quality of life. We don't just do it for, you know, species X, Y, or Z. We do it because it's about well-being and quality of life. So indeed, we need to think big. I think we need to think big because it's a big thing that we need to focus on. And then again, I would say, indeed, I'm not pleading for everybody to pack their bags and travel the world for 2 years. You can have a nature experience very nearby, but we're just not used to looking for it anymore. We've sort of lost that along the way. So by focusing on that sort of things, I think we can really make a step forward, and then at the level of the agency, we will monitor all the great improvements that we are jointly creating, and we can then send better messages to the European citizens about nature and biodiversity. Yeah.
Thank you, and I'd like to draw this panel to a close, and I'd like to just take a moment to just share with you two moments of nature that are happening here in Belgium. First is, in the apartment I used to live in, there was a tree outside, and I used to watch the birds that arrived. And there was a bird that looked a little strange. I hadn't seen it before. And we took down and we identified that it was a particular bird that had not been seen in Belgium overwintering before. So I had great pleasure in being able to inform the Belgian Society for Bird Watchers that it was now overwintering, and it was in the garden outside my window and was eating the fat balls that I'd put out for them. So even in an urban environment, in a working context, and also that hopefully things are happening in the next generation. My son is 2 years old, and for Mother's Day he was sent home from the creche with a little pot of growing herbs instead of a chocolate or a card. Now, as he gave it to me, it was sort of held sideways with the sort of bits of the plant hanging out. He didn't quite understand fully what he had, but I'm hoping that this is a sign of change, that the next generation at a really early stage is starting to be taught about nature and how to grow things, and maybe the connection with food will be different. And that's my hope for the next generation. So thank you very much for your time and your attention, for the panelists, for respecting very clearly our time pressure and being able to respond. I would like to say that there is a cocktail that's happening outside this room. For those who are going to be listening online, sadly, they can't join the cocktail. But you will be able to have a real-life drink as we finish. So on your behalf, thank you to all the panelists. And in... finally, keep the conversation going on the Debating Europe platform.